Hi everyone, this is Carrie, and this podcast is going to cover hemodynamic monitoring, and then a second podcast that also correlates with the PowerPoints is going to cover the circulatory assistive devices. Before I begin with the PowerPoint, I would like you to kind of review the general circulation of the heart if you don't remember the blood flow through the heart. Also, there's a handout that you got along with this packet of information that was titled The Basic Concepts of Cardiac Physiology. So if you haven't taken a chance to review that worksheet as well, it's just a front and back of a page that talks about the circulatory system, preload, afterload, cardiac output, stroke volume, heart rate, what all of those mean. So those are some of the basic concepts. Here in critical care, we're going to delve much deeper than what each of those things are, because we're going to learn how to monitor them. So if you don't know, understand what they are, it's going to be hard to understand the purpose of monitoring them. So please take a few minutes, pause this podcast if needed, and review that worksheet. I'm going to start now on the first slide, or the second slide, actually, that talks about hemodynamic monitoring. When we monitor someone's hemodynamic status, we're measuring the pressure, flow, and oxygenation within the cardiovascular system. The purpose of our hemodynamic monitoring is to assess heart function, fluid balance, and the effects of the fluid and different medications on our cardiac output. Then we can have both invasive and non-invasive ways of measuring. Invasive means we're putting something inside the body, where non-invasive means we're doing it externally. Either way, we're going to have some different ways of hemodynamic measurements that we can look at and analyze. Some of these include, and you see them listed there on the slide, systemic and pulmonary artery pressures, central venous pressure, which is annotated, we usually abbreviate that as CVP, pulmonary artery wedge pressure, which is PAWP. Sometimes it's also can be known as pulmonary artery occlusive pressure, but I will not address it in that way. It'll always be pulmonary artery wedge pressure for this class. It also looks at cardiac output as well as cardiac index, and we'll go through what each of those mean a little bit more thoroughly here on the next few slides. So additional measurements, when we're talking about hemodynamic monitoring, can be obtained with stroke volume and stroke volume index, stroke volume variations, O2 sat of the hemoglobin of arterial blood, as well as mixed venous oxygen saturation. And we've talked about your SaO2 before, quite a bit before. Now this time we're going to add a few more pieces into that mix with the stroke volume and the mixed venous oxygen saturation. From these measurements, we can calculate several values, including the resistance of the system and pulmonary artery vasculature and O2 content, delivery, and consumption. So we're going to get actually a lot of really good information from these different measurements. When we integrate the data, we get the picture of our patient's hemodynamic status and the effects of therapy over time. So we're going to look a lot at trending when we're thinking about these measurements. What's getting better? What's getting worse? What have we done in the meantime that's caused these changes? Or is the patient just getting better? We all have to analyze all of those pieces. We also have, because we're using a lot of technology to make these measurements, we have to pay attention to the technical accuracy of them. Inaccurate data can result in unnecessary or inappropriate treatment. So when we're talking about these specific devices, we're going to talk about zeroing them, making sure that the measurements that we're actually going to get are as accurate as possible. One thing I do want to just kind of briefly mention as well before we move on to the next slide is the I just want to clarify in your mind the difference between your SaO2 and your PaO2, because we're going to be talking again, not necessarily in this podcast, but in various ones about your ABGs. And in your ABG, you have an SaO2 measurement and you also have a PaO2 measurement. Remember that the PA is the amount of oxygen that's actually circulating in your blood that has either hooked to the hemoglobin or is in the process to it. So it's telling you how much oxygen is available for use. So that's different than your SAO2, because your SAO2 is the saturation. And that means how much oxygen is actually saturated onto your hemoglobin so it can be distributed to the tissues. Even if you have a lot of oxygen in your blood, if it's not saturated onto the hemoglobin, it's not going to get to where it needs to go. But vice versa, if your saturation is low as well, but we don't have oxygen in the blood to hook onto it, then we know that we need to increase the oxygen. So by understanding the difference between those two concepts can help us figure out the types of treatment we need to do. And so as we go through this PowerPoint, I'll try to help point some of those things out so they can become clear in your mind as well. So moving on to the next slide, it talks about cardiac output. Remember, cardiac output is the volume of blood in liters pumped by the heart in 1 minute. So these actually are just some terminology reviews for you, these next few slides. So hopefully just to remind you of what they are. Cardiac index is the measurement of the cardiac output adjusted for body surface area. It is more precise measurement of the efficiency of the pumping action of the heart. We don't always see that calculated, but that's what cardiac index means. It's you just using the total body surface area in the measurement. Although minor beat-to-beat changes can occur, generally the left and right ventricles pump the same volume. The volume ejected with each heartbeat is known as the stroke volume. Like cardiac index, stroke volume index, the SVI, is the measurement of stroke volume, but adjusted for the body surface area as well. The next slide talks about systemic vascular resistance. That is the opposition encountered by the left ventricle. Or you can have pulmonary vascular resistance, PVR, which is the opposition encountered by the right ventricle. And so therefore, that is the resistance to blood flow by the vessels. So SVR and pulmonary vascular resistance is the amount of force it's going to take to get blood out of either the vessels from the lungs or the heart to the rest of the body based on the pressures. Hypertension is a real big one with that. So if there's high blood pressure, those vessels are constricted and it's going to be harder to get the blood out. So that's just something to think about with that. Preload, afterload, and contractility determine our stroke volume and therefore also cardiac output and blood pressure. It's essential that we understand these concepts and their relationships. In addition, we need to also understand the effects of manipulation of each of these variables and how they affect each other. There is a table in your book that shows some normal values for common hemodynamic monitoring. And so the tables in this book, or in the section in this book, currently it's chapter 66, but it is basically whatever edition you have, it's the critical care chapter, and it talks through those values well. You don't necessarily need to understand normals. What is a normal value with these? Memorize the numbers. We will tell you if it's high or low, because that's the main thing you need to know. If it's high or low, then what do we do about it? So that's what I want you to know with that. So let's talk again about preload. What does it mean? So preload is the volume within the ventricle at the end of diastole. Remember, diastole is a resting pressure of the heart. If we think about our blood pressure, we have systolic pressure and our diastolic pressure. Our diastolic is the lower number. And so the top number, our systole, is the force it takes to get the blood out. And the diastolic is the resting pressure of the heart. So at the end of diastole, the preload is the volume that's within the heart. So the amount of blood that fills the heart before it contracts. Unfortunately, chamber volume measurements are difficult to obtain. Instead, various pressures are used to estimate our volume. Left ventricular preload is also called left ventricular end diastolic pressure. You'll hear us interchange those terms. Pulmonary artery wedge pressure, or PAWP, is a measurement of pulmonary capillary pressure. This reflects the left ventricular end diastolic pressure under normal conditions, where there is no other dysfunction, cardiac, heart dysrhythmia, anything like that. So again, if we're looking at the number for pulmonary artery wedge pressure, it's going to tell us left ventricular end diastolic pressure under normal conditions. Central venous pressure is measured in the right atrium or in the vena cava close to the heart. So the right ventricle preload or right ventricular end diastolic pressure when there's no valve dysfunction. So let's think about this a little bit. So pulmonary artery wedge pressure, if we think about where that is, that's in the pulmonary artery. So if we think when something is backing up, those pressures are going to increase when the pressures kind of go backwards through the heart. So what would have to build up, what area of the heart, in order for the pressures in the lungs to build up? And that is the left ventricle. If we're thinking backwards, because from the heart, or from after it fills in the heart, it goes to the lungs to get oxygenation, then it comes into the left side, left atrium, left ventricle. So if the left preload is high in the left ventricle, the pressures are going to be backing up into the left of atrium and back up into that pulmonary artery, which we're going to see with an increase in a pulmonary artery wedge pressure. Same thing with central venous pressure. The tip of that catheter, that sensor, is right at the tip of the right atrium. So if we think about where that pressure is measuring, we have to continue to trace backwards in the heart, because before it gets to the lungs, we have the right ventricle, right atrium, and then into the vena cava, because it's close to the heart. So when we have right ventricular preload or high amounts there, that's going to be the central venous pressure, because it's right, we're measuring that pressure before it gets to the heart. Hopefully that's not so confusing. If you have questions about that, please don't hesitate to ask. I don't know if you remember learning about Frank Starling's law, and that would have been in med-surg. That explains the effects of preload and the states that more a myocardial fiber stretching during filling, the more it shortens during the systole or the contraction, and the greater the force of the contraction. So as preload increases, so again, preload is the volume, the force generated in the subsequent contraction increases, therefore stroke volume and cardiac output increase. So the more volume that is, the larger, the bigger the heart muscle has to stretch, the more force is going to be created. Therefore, we're going to push more blood out because more blood is there. So cardiac output's going to be increased, as well as stroke volume. The greater the preload, the greater the myocardial stretch, and the greater the O2 requirement by the myocardium. So therefore, an increase in cardiac output via increased preload requires an increased oxygen delivery as well to the myocardium. So we're working all parts of the heart and the lungs in this sense. Diuresis, so if we're going to give them diuretics or vasodilator medication, those decrease preload because we're decreasing. Remember, preload is related to volume, okay? And so, and fluid administration increases preload. So if we're going to increase volume in any way, we're going to put them on an IV fluid, we're increasing preload. Hopefully that makes sense. If not, go ahead and rewind it and listen to that again. Afterload is the next slide. I want to talk about that. Afterload refers to the force opposing ventricular ejection. So what force is causing issues for us? These forces include systemic arterial pressure, so what pressure is in the arteries, the resistance offered by the aortic valve, and the mass and density of the blood to be moved, so how thick is the blood. Clinically, although the measures fail to include all the components of afterload, SVR and arterial pressure are indices of left ventricular afterload. Remember, what does SVR stand for? Systemic vascular resistance. So it talks about the tightening of the vessels. Similarly, PVR, pulmonary vascular resistance, and pulmonary arterial pressures are indices of right ventricular afterload. So you, again, have to really kind of slow down and think about where, what it's asking, what the abbreviation stands for, and what it would be measuring and what it would mean. So increased afterload often results in a decreased cardiac output. So the more constricted the vessels are that the heart has to push against, the less blood that's going to be ejected, okay? So the increase of the forces, so the tighter the vessels are, results in a decreased cardiac output. Cardiac output can be restored and myocardial oxygen needs reduced by decreasing afterload, therefore decreasing forces opposing the contraction. Vasodilator medications can reduce afterload. Milrinone is one that you might see used. That's just an example of a vasodilator medication. All right, moving on to the next slide, vascular resistance. Systemic vascular resistance is a resistance of the systemic vascular system, whereas pulmonary vascular resistance is a resistance within the pulmonary vascular system. Both of these measures reflect afterload, as described earlier, and can be adjusted related to body size. Contractility refers to the strength of the contraction of the heart muscle. It is said to increase when preload is unchanged, yet the heart contracts more forcefully. There are no direct clinical measures of cardiac contractility. We know that when someone has heart failure, the larger the heart stretches, and for the longer lengths of time that heart stretches, the muscles actually can become weaker based on too much stretch for too long. And that can affect contractility, although we don't have any specific measurement at this point anyway that measures that specifically. All right, I want to briefly talk through a case study as we go through this PowerPoint. AJ, he's a 78-year-old male, admitted to the ICU in acute decompensated heart failure. Healthcare provider decides to insert an arterial line and a pulmonary artery catheter to facilitate treatment decisions. So what equipment are we going to need in preparation for insertion of these lines? And that actually is going to lead us into our discussion here in the next section. In the ICU, some of you have already been there. If you haven't been there yet, you will be. You're going to see multiple invasive lines in an ICU, and they're used to measure systemic and pulmonary blood pressures is one of the things they measure. There's a picture in your textbook that actually shows the components of the typical invasive arterial blood pressure monitoring system, and actually there's pictures right there on your slide as well. You may see this in the wrist there, when it's inserted into your artery. It may be known as an ART line, A-R-T line for arterial line. And we can get multiple blood pressure and pulmonary readings off of that. So the cannula shown entering in the radial artery is connected via a pressure tubing and a transducer. The transducer converts the pressure wave into an electronic signal. The transducer is wired to the electronic monitoring system, which amplifies, conditions, displays, and records a signal. You'll see stopcock there as well. There's stopcocks inserted into the line for specimen withdrawal and for recognizing, for referencing and zeroing the device. And remember, that's very important for accuracy. Also, if someone is critically ill and we're needing to measure their internal blood pressures through an ART line, we're generally drawing frequent ABGs as well. So this allows us to get that arterial blood without having to do multiple pokes. This flush system is consistent of a pressurized bag of IV fluid, which you can see in that picture as well. It has tubing, a flush device, and that is also inserted into that line right above that stopcock. The flush system provides continuous slow, generally only about 3 mLs per hour flushing, and provides a mechanism for fast flushing of the line if needed. Again, that is to prevent the clots. The catheter, pressure tubing, flush system, and transducer are all disposable, so when the patient gets better and that is pulled, they can actually just dispose of it like they would regular IV tubing. Next slide goes back to our case study. So why is it important to zero reference the transducer and perform a dynamic response test during initial setup of the equipment for AJ? That's one question. And where is the phlebostatic access located? And those probably are both kind of questions you don't know yet. So we're going to talk about those in the next slides. So pressure monitoring equipment is referenced and zero balanced to the environment and dynamic response characteristics optimized for accuracy. And all you really need to know is that they need to be zeroed out. You don't necessarily need to understand the procedure. We're not going to be testing on that. Although when you actually go and observe in an ICU, it'd be interesting for you to know exactly what they're doing. Referencing means positioning the transducer so that the zero reference point is at the level of the atria of the heart. And the next slide actually shows that. There's a picture on the next slide, so we'll talk through that in a little bit. The stopcock nearest the transducer is usually the zero reference for the transducer. And to place this level with the atria, you use an external landmark, which is known as the phlebostatic axis. And again, You'll see that picture there on the next slide of the phlebostatic axis. I just cannot say that word. Anyway, to figure out, identify where that phlebostatic axis is, we need to draw two imaginary lines with the patient supine. And you can see how they've done this in the drawing. So we draw a horizontal line down from the axilla, midway between the anterior and posterior chest walls. Then we also draw a vertical line laterally through the fourth intercostal space along the chest wall. The phlebostatic axis is the intersection of these two imaginary lines. And what they need generally do then is they find this spot on the patient and mark it with a permanent marker. We position the port of the stopcock nearest the transducer level with this phlebostatic axis. Tape the transducer to the patient's chest at this point or mount it on the bedside pole, again, level with this to make sure that our readings are accurate. Zeroing this device confirms that when pressure within the system is zero, the monitor is also going to read zero. To do this, we need to open the reference stopcock at room air and observe and monitor for the reading of zero. This allows the monitor to use the atmospheric pressure as a reference for zero, so therefore it's going to be as accurate as possible. Zero the transducer during the normal initial setup, immediately after insertion of the ART line, and when the transducer has been disconnected from the pressure cable or the pressure cable has been disconnected from the monitor. Also, when the accuracy of the measurement is questioned. With any of these devices, the manufacturer also sends guidelines as to when they need to be referenced or zeroed, and we need to use those as well. The next slide talks about the dynamic wave response and the waveform. I'm not going to be testing on this with understanding these waveforms on this exam. I don't necessarily feel that's critical for you to know. But based on the waveforms you see, it's going to then tell you the accuracy of the measure that they're trying to get. And that's basically what I would like you to get from that slide. Moving on, talks about the types of invasive procedure pressure monitoring. So let's talk about this ART line a little bit more. So with an ART line, arterial pressure line, we can have continuous arterial blood pressure monitoring, and it is indicated for patients in many situations, including acute hypertension or hypotension, respiratory failure, shock, which we've just learned about, neurologic injury, coronary interventional procedures, so if they're having anything done with their heart, continuous infusion of vasoactive drugs, such as nitro. If they're getting a nitroprusside drip, they might need that. Also, if we're needing to draw frequent ABGs, they may also put it in. A 20-gauge, 2-inch, non-tapered Teflon catheter is typically used to cannulate a peripheral artery, generally the radial or femoral artery, using a percutaneous approach. So after insertion, again, as a nurse, you will not do this. That will be inserted by specially trained personnel. After insertion, the catheter is usually sutured in place. It must be immobilized at the insertion site to prevent dislodging or kinking of the tube. Our next slide actually shows us a picture of the arterial pressure monitoring, what the monitor itself will look like, and how it correlates with the ECG. The top one is the recording of the ECG tracing, where B is actually the ART line tracing that we see. And a lot of times we're going to want to know what the mean pressure is of the ART line, and that is the average pressure over time calculated by the monitoring equipment. And that will tell us on a separate little screen what that is. And that's all the more you need to know with analyzing that picture. You don't need to go any more in depth with that. So let's talk about the next slide. It goes back to our case study with AJ. So when planning care for AJ, what nursing interventions will you perform to prevent complications related to his ART line? So we need to think about what actual complications could occur. So first we're going to talk about some alarms, and then we're going to go into the complications. And the next slide starts that thought here. So we do have high and low pressure alarms, and they're based on the patient's current status and then activated. So they will be set individually for each patient. So with an arterial line, it's going to carry the risk of hemorrhage, infection, thrombus formation, neurovascular impairment, and the loss of the limb. And I want to talk about each of those a little bit more specifically. Hemorrhage itself is most likely to occur when the catheter dislodges or the line disconnects. So to avoid this complication, use a lure lock connection to make sure it stays tight. Always check the arterial waveform and active alarms. If the pressure in the line falls, or which would happen if it got disconnected, the low pressure alarm will sound immediately, allowing you to promptly correct the problem. If there is an infection, we always have high risk for infection anytime we have an invasive line into a patient. So to limit this risk of a catheter-related infection, we need to inspect the insertion site for local signs of inflammation and monitor the patient for signs and symptoms of systemic infection. Again, when we look at, you just talked about SIRS and sepsis, we need to monitor for those signs as well. We need to change the pressure tubing, flush the bag and transducer every 96 hours or according to our agency's policy. If there is an infection suspected, we need to remove the catheter and replace the equipment. Depending on the facility, if it's thought to be the source of an infection, the catheter tip itself may need to go to lab to be analyzed. It also can cause circulatory impairment that results from a thrombus formation around the catheter. It could be release of an embolus, a spasm, or occlusion of circulation by the catheter. So, very important, before inserting the line into the radial artery, we need to perform an Allen's test to confirm that ulnar circulation to the hand is adequate, because we have two arteries leading to the hand, and we need to make sure they are both going well, have a lot of good fluid flowing through them. So if we use one of them, we're not completely cutting off the circulation to the hand. So to do this, we ask, we apply pressure to the radial and ulnar arteries simultaneously. So we ask the patient to open and close the hand repeatedly once we've applied pressure to the arteries. But when the patient does this, the hand should blanch or become white. Release the pressure on the ulnar artery while remaining pressure on the radial artery. If pinkness fails to return within 6 seconds, the ulnar artery is inadequate and we should not use the radial artery for the line insertion. Then they would need to perform the test on the other hand to see if they would have adequate blood flow in the other arm, other hand. So the next slide talks about the continuous flushing irrigation system. To maintain line patency and limbus thrombus formation access the continuous flush system every 1 to 4 hours to determine that the pressure, well, to determine three things. Number one, that the pressure bag is inflated to 300 milligrams. We want to flush the bag. Flush bag contains fluid, and three, the system is delivering 3 to 6 mLs per hour. Again, we're using only saline here. If we would use heparin, because of the amount they would need to keep it open, we would use too much heparin, and we could send them into a heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. So we need to be very careful with that. So heparin is not routinely used for an ART line. Once our catheter is inserted, we need to evaluate the neurovascular status distal to the arterial insertion site hourly. So the limb with compromised arterial flow will be cool and pale with capillary refill time longer than 3 seconds. There may be symptoms of neurologic impairment, such as paresthesias, pain, paralysis in that hand. Neurovascular impairment, which can also result actually in a loss of a limb if we do not catch it early enough, which can be an emergency as well. So we need to monitor very closely what's going on with that arterial line. Arterial pressure-based cardiac output monitoring, also known as APCO, is used. I'm not going to be testing on this, so we're not going to necessarily, you can read through this if you want, but because I'm not testing on it, I'm not going to take the time to go through it. This is a less invasive, it's minimally invasive technique for determining continuous cardiac output. So depending on what the patient is in for, they may want to have this monitor used as well. The next slide actually shows a picture of an APCO monitor. Generally, your APCO monitor is frequently used in conjunction with a central venous oximeter catheter, and that's your SCVO2. That's your SCVO2 saturation, central venous oxygen saturation. Together, these allows for continuous monitoring of the O2 sat, systemic vascular resistance, as well, that is derived from the central venous pressure. So The ABCO itself does have some limitations. Currently, it's used on patients who are mechanically ventilated with fixed respiratory rates. So again, you probably won't see this device used. Due to the length of this first part of this podcast, I'm going to end this one here. The next podcast is going to now then pick up on a pulmonary artery pressure monitor. So we will start with the pulmonary artery monitoring on the next with the next podcast. Thank you for listening. Please sure to ask questions if there's something you don't understand.